From the land of Grand University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the third day of February 2017. I'm Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Mike Zuzulo. He's a global commodity analytics and consulting out of Atchison, Kansas. A bit later in the program, we'll discuss fertility in pork production with a swine specialist here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the U of I, Rob Knox. And as we close out our time together, we'll take up the weather forecast. We'll discuss it with Eric Snodgrass from Agrible right here on this Friday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media on this Friday afternoon. It's the third day of February. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason, joined now by Mike Zuzulo. He's a global commodity analytics and consulting in Atchison, Kansas. Thanks for being with us, Mike.
Great to be with you, Todd. Happy Friday, sir.
Happy Friday to you as well. You've been traveling a bit, talking to farmers about their plans for the coming year and expectations for prices and old crop, too. What have you heard this week?
The pressure to plant, and we had talked about this a couple commodity weeks ago, the pressure to plant soybeans in the Western Corn Belt is very, very strong, and it's mainly lender pressure right now, Todd, but the basis is not there yet to get the acres. Now, in the Eastern Corn Belt, my suspicions of what's been going on in the Eastern and Central Corn Belt were supported with the idea that not only do you not have the lender pressure, because a couple of meetings I did were both crop insurance and banks sponsored, so we did have a lending presence there quite a bit. But not only did the lenders not have much pressure on the producers as far as coming out of rotation because of cost of production needs, but they are very wet and very saturated in their ground over there in really the whole eastern half of Indiana and most of Ohio. It's really setting up for an ideal corn planting spring. Unless they just keep raining, because they've got lots and lots of water to start with now.
You see, soybeans are down a dime in the nearby March. The November contract is down 8.75. What moved it today?
I think the big number, obviously, was Informa's Brazil bean production number jumping in there at 106.5 million tons. Now, if you would take both Brazil and Argentina in what Informa said, you're looking at 161.5 million tons of production between the two countries. It's only 500,000 tons different from what USDA gave us in January. But the trade was set up for a lower Brazil number and a much lower Argentine number. I mean, I'm at 104 in Brazil and 52 in Argentina, so that'd be a total of 156. I think the trade was around that area too. So I think you essentially threw about 5 million more tons into the marketplace from what they were expecting on next week's report.
So do you suppose that USDA will follow suit with the Informa number? CONAB numbers are coming out too.
Yeah, I do not expect that. I don't think USDA will be that aggressive. If they do take the Brazilian numbers up, I suspect that they'll take the Argentine numbers down, because they're still sitting at 57 million tons in Argentina. So I think that's quite high, and I would say the Argentine number, you know, is not a done deal. It could go lower, even though we did get a fresh number earlier this week of 56.5 million tons that kind of surprised the market as well. But clearly, between all the South American bean production numbers this week, you had a much more defensive market, and that's why March beans closed down 22.75 and Novi beans closed down 15.75, while corn and wheat had higher weeks this week.
So you're still looking at the supply side, both in the United States and now from South America, to continue to depress prices. Will they do that more than they have already over the longer term, do you think?
Well, I don't know if I look for them to depress prices, after the report. I guess the way I would look at this week's numbers that came out was we have little reason to buy the market because of these numbers before the report and put any kind of weather premium into the November bean futures. But if you don't break the beans after the report and USDA comes out and we hold these lows this week, that's probably going to suggest to me a buy signal and a chance to get another rally to be able to sell into.
Yeah, that would be an interesting and hopeful for producers. It also would happen at a time when they're hopeful that they'll get a higher insurance number, yeah. Right? Yeah. So.
Right. Great point. Great point. But yeah, these are big numbers. I mean, you know, 106.5 is a big number, and if the market can tolerate that after the USDA report, we factored in a lot of supply.
Yeah. By comparison, it started the year, I think, at 102. And went to 104 at USDA now.
Exactly.
And frankly, if you listen to Commodity Week, there was a 106, a 108, and a 110 number dropped yesterday afternoon during Commodity Week by one of the analysts, though I don't recall exactly which one dropped those numbers out at this point. You can listen to it online and find out. So there are some numbers out there that are really big. Producers, however, have been watching the commodity market, soybeans in particular, even corn. Exports have been good for both, and they remain fairly strong, I think, don't they?
Oh, they do. And I think this is where, between the bean numbers and the trade rhetoric, you know, with fresh information coming out of Washington, fresh information coming out of Australia, the trade rhetoric fears continued to bring about some dollar safe haven bias at times this past week, if you ask me. But if you take that out of the picture, I think otherwise, with this strong demand that you're referencing and tighter corn supplies in Europe that we got news from the European Commission at midweek, I think that gave the market quite a bit of lift and surprised the market, quite frankly. And I think the Kansas wheat numbers, as far as the conditions of very poor and poor actually slipping, and they actually went up a point in January versus December, I think that really put a solid support feature in the wheat market. And it was nice to see the hard red wheat lead the soft red wheat up, March soft red up 9 cents on the week. And you notice at the end of the week, we're still hanging around some pretty key technical resistance levels. And that March 370, 200-day moving average is not that far away in the corn market. And if wheat wants to go up another leg after the USDA report next week because of the weather fears, Todd, I think that we could see some technical buying in the corn. It's one of those reports kind of similar to what we've been dealing with, I think, is that you have the potential with a weaker dollar and strong demand and a little bit tighter supplies in wheat and corn that you could generate a fresh buy signal after these numbers if they don't, USDA doesn't come in and really throw a lot of supply onto the market.
What do you think of the 2 months worth of record-setting production, more than 1 million barrels per day for ethanol in the United States?
It's very, very good, but I also think that the crude oil market and the unleaded market and the diesel market supplies are getting up to levels we hadn't seen since last November and last August, depending on which refined product you're looking at. So I'd be watching if the gas prices don't come down nationally, I'd be watching to see if we don't have a little bit more pressure in the ethanol market from the energy sector. But it goes, your other point in bringing this up makes me think of, we've got extremely strong livestock demand. Does the USDA really have that factored in? Extremely strong ethanol demand. Do they have that factored in? And especially the exports, another week where we were 20 some percent above the 4 week average. And we're getting closer to halfway through the marketing year. We're running 75% ahead of last marketing year, and they've only got us up 17%. That could be one of the best features to next week's report if they actually come in and say, we need to increase this. The Brazilians and Argentines aren't going to take as much business away from me, it doesn't seem.
How many bushels do you think that might represent?
I would say conservatively 200 million bushels, because you just cut that 75% down into a third, and that's 250 million bushels. So I would take another 50 million off that and say we could be right back towards a 2 billion bushel carryover. And the interesting thing, Todd, is if you look at the marketing year of corn exports, both last year and the five-year average, we actually incline greater as the marketing year progresses. We don't flatten out or go down in either of those two time periods. We actually increase the incline and we gain more market share. So we don't have to do a lot to keep that double digit 30-40% higher than last year and essentially double what USDA expects.
Hey, thanks so much for taking the time with me today. We'll talk with you next week and see you in Sycamore on Wednesday.
That sounds great. My pleasure, sir.
And of course, is Mike Zuzulo. He's with Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting out of Atchison, Kansas. In today's agricultural news, President Trump's nominee to head the Environmental Protection Agency advanced to the full Senate despite Democrats boycotting for a second day. A committee vote on Oklahoma Attorney General Scott Pruitt. Democrats insisted Pruitt had not answered their questions. Illinois' Tammy Duckworth scolded Pruitt at his confirmation hearing, calling his commitment to the renewable fuel standard key for agriculture, vague and not reassuring. But when it came time to vote for or against Pruitt, Duckworth and her colleagues stayed away from the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee. Republicans had boycotted a 2013 vote on Obama second-term EPA nominee Gina McCarthy. The panel chair suspended committee voting rules that required the presence of at least two Democrats and called up Pruitt's nomination.
It is unprecedented for the minority to delay an EPA administrator for an incoming president to this extent. We had an election last November, the people spoke, and now it is time to set up a functioning government. That includes a functioning EPA. To do that, this committee has to do its work.
Republicans then approved Pruitt's nomination for full Senate consideration. The Senate Finance Committee earlier did the same for the president's Treasury and HHS nominees when Democrats boycotted those votes, too. Now the threat is filibuster on the Senate floor that could further delay action on Trump cabinet picks and slow nominations yet to be heard in committee. This includes former Georgia Governor Sonny Perdue for USDA Secretary. Iowa Republican Joni Ernst accused Democrats of obstructionism.
When people have honest differences of opinion, we debate it. But when the goal is simply obstructionism, I would draw this conclusion. We are not responding to the needs of the American people if there is not an EPA administrator.
EPA chiefs of both parties remain controversial. Obama EPA Chief McCarthy was a lightning rod for agriculture, especially on the waters of the U.S., a rule that Scott Pruitt opposed in the courts. Well, let's come out of Washington, D.C. for the afternoon and head to Missouri. It was a hotbed of complaint last year regarding the off-label use of dicamba as the product drifted onto sensitive crops and plants that were not resistant to the product. A DTN report says new legislation is now before the Missouri legislature that would impose stiff fines on farmers if they misuse dicamba this growing season. Missouri Republican Representative Don Roan says the goal of the legislation is to make sure the state's growers use the product correctly. Farmers would be fined $1,000 per treated acre if they're caught using the product off-label. The current fine in Missouri is $1,000 per incident. The Missouri Soybean Association says farmers have been at the table during these discussions and they'll continue to work on this. Communications Director Christine Tu says our position has not changed since last summer. Growers must read and follow label directions. The legislation also designates any fine money that's collected would go to the school district where the incident took place. The bill also requires product manufacturers to provide grower training, which can be done electronically, and requires dealers to ask for proof of taking such a class before a dicamba sale can take place. And finally today, the pork industry says, hey, wait a second, there's no shortage of bacon. There's been awfully high demand for bacon, and it's driven pork belly supplies to record lows, prompting talk of a nationwide bacon shortage. However, the pork industry remains confident it can keep up with the increasing demand and avoid a serious shortage of the product. An Associated Press report says the bottom line is a pound of bacon might be a little more expensive over the rest of this winter, but the price should stabilize by the summer. A recent U.S. Department of Agriculture report says pork belly supplies fell to 17.7 million pounds last month. That's the lowest number since record keeping began back in 1957. Wholesale prices are already showing an increase, and while retail prices aren't increasing yet, they could rise as the industry works to catch up. Steve Meyer, a pork industry economist for Express Market, says he is not concerned about the shortage in pork belly stockpiles, as pork production likely will increase 3% this year. To keep pace with increased pork demand, the industry is building at least four new processing plants in Iowa, Minnesota, Missouri, and Michigan in the next few years. And that's a look at today's agricultural news. You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It's public radio for the farming world. We recorded Commodity Week yesterday afternoon on some of these stations. It'll air this afternoon, tomorrow morning on the rest. And if you can't take time now or later to hear it on the radio, you can always visit our website at willag.org and look up Commodity Week. We're on iTunes, NPR One, and you can find us at Google as well. Our panelists this week included Dan Zwicker, Roy Huckabee, Joe Vaclavek, and Pete Manhart. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Up next, farmers raising pigs around the planet are always looking for ways to improve the productivity of their breeding herds. They have long used artificial insemination to increase fertility and improve genetics. In a moment, I'll have more on the latest technologies in this area. You know, if like me, you visit with livestock producers very often, you'll soon land on the topic of the breeding herd. More likely than not, the discussion will involve some novel approaches to increasing fertility. For instance, I once covered some research that involved garage door openers. Turns out that if you can track how often a heifer is being mounted by its lot companions, other heifers, then you can better time when to put the bull in the pen. Just put the garage door opener on the heifer's back and set up a computer to track how often and when it's clicked. That's pretty simple technology. There's some really intense stuff, too. I learned just a tidbit during the Illinois Pork Expo this year. Rob Knox told me about post-cervical artificial insemination. That's PCAI for short, among other things.
This has kind of been a change over the last few years that a lot of farms are using lower doses of semen to inseminate sows deeper than the conventional catheter. So that's really kind of picking up speed here. There's some new products globally, one approved in the U.S. for ovulation induction, it's called OviGel, and that product allows breeders to only inseminate sows one time at a fixed time. And that's a new product and trying to gain some traction here. The whole intention for this is if you can use a lower dose of semen and only use a single insemination, you can access higher indexing genetically valued boars to pass on very important, economically important traits into the market production animals.
It's possible to increase fertility and improve genetics at a cheaper cost by using a new artificial insemination method that requires smaller amounts of semen. Cut to the chase, it is possible to breed more sows with the same amount of semen. Consequently, the farmer can purchase better genetics with which to improve the herd. Now, Rob Knox, by the way, is an extension swine specialist based on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the U of I. It was at this point in the conversation that I started thinking about the improved fertility rates and the potential for this technology to be transferred into people. It happens all the time in the animal sciences. Blood pressure medicine is a good example. It came from work done at the University of Wisconsin to control rodents in dairy barns. So I asked Knox if PCAI might be used in humans. Turns out the technology transfer went the opposite direction this time.
A lot of this work has actually been developed in the humans for trying to fix infertility in females. And so a lot of the medical costs developed these drugs for use in women over the past 40 years. And now there's been opportunities to adapt them for use in livestock and try to figure out how they're valuable. And I think this is one particular product, this OviGel product, is one of them. It picked a GnRH analog, normally secreted hormone, and they were able to synthesize that. And a lot of that work came from the human side.
Cool stuff, huh? Brought to you by science, research, and discovery. How about that? For University of Illinois Extension, I'm Todd Gleason. This is the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason. We're now joined by Eric Snodgrass. He's from Agrible right here in Urbana-Champaign. Eric, thanks much. It's been a difficult forecast here in the United States, especially as we're looking forward to the weekend. It's Super Bowl time. What do you think?
Well, Todd, one of the things that we've really struggled with over the last week was this Super Bowl Sunday forecast. About a week ago, I was looking at a little system that was going to come in on a weak little trough in the jet stream that was going to go right across southern Illinois, potentially bringing us some snow in this part of the country. And over the last several days, that part of the jet stream just flattened out and pushed that low way to the north into Wisconsin. And as a result, we're not really expected to have too much adverse weather this weekend. So it looks like for our Super Bowl weekend, we're going to have pretty decent weather.
I guess that's good news for folks in the state of Illinois wanting to watch the Super Bowl this Sunday. Should be able to do that under comfortable conditions. Hey, it's the start of February, and that means the groundhogs are out. Any long-term predictions?
Just so that you know, some interesting statistics about that groundhog. You know, we've been basically pulling him out of that box for about 130 years, and over that time, he's really favored his six more weeks of winter forecast. In fact, he's done that well over 100 times. But you should know that the statistics for the groundhog being correct come in right around 38%. So basically, whatever the groundhog says, maybe it's smarter to go against what he says. And in reality, you know, spring doesn't start until March 21st anyway, so that's about 6.5 weeks away. But if we think about the Groundhog's Day forecast in the context of 2017, I know that he saw a shadow, or according to that, you know, old folklore, we're looking at another 6 weeks of winter, but I think this year's a good year to go against it. Now, you're not going to see spring tomorrow. It's still February. It's still cold in this part of the world. But there are some pretty strong indications that we're going to see a warmer than average February on the whole, maybe just a degree or two warmer than average for the eastern half of the country. And that's pretty much everywhere except for the northern plains, potentially the Pacific Northwest. And it's those northern plains we got to talk about, okay? So this year across the northern plains, let's think the Dakotas. I was just there the other day, and I'll tell you, there's some pretty significant snows in the central part of South Dakota and almost all of North Dakota. Some places are already at over 50 inches this year. So while the eastern half of the country might be able to enjoy that warmth, a little bit of warmth, I should say, for February and March, the northern part of the Corn Belt looks to have a colder than average February. And keep this in context here. The last 2 years, they've had a warm March, April, and May. So we've had fewer prevent plant acres. I think this year that the Dakotas might be the first kind of sign of maybe some struggle with the 2017 growing season with the return toward normal, you know, prevent plant acres. Basically, the soil stays frozen or there's too much snow on top of it that melts, keeping things too muddy to get in those fields. So we got to watch that very closely.
Okay, watching North Dakota, but what about the rest of the Corn Belt?
Coming back to, our part of the Corn Belt, one thing we're watching for this weekend is from pretty decent weather, but to our west, there's a pretty significant trough that's digging into the jet stream. Now, why I'm concerned about this is that that trough is going to allow for some southerly winds to push into our area on Sunday and Monday, keeping us about 10 degrees above average. Right now, I'm not seeing any precipitation, but still a little bit warmer than average. By Tuesday, though, as this big low pressure system gets cranking in the middle part of the country and then makes its way toward kind of the Chicagoland area, we're going to be seeing some pretty strong southerly winds. And with this system, as deep as it gets, with that low over Chicago, the northern part of the growing belt, so we're talking Wisconsin, we're talking parts of Minnesota, maybe parts of Iowa, could be seeing 5, 10, maybe more inches of snow. We'll be to the south of it, which means we're going to be dealing with rain out of this system, but it's going to be a big one. And then what happens is because it is so deep and because the trough behind it is so deep, once this moves off to the northeast, we're going to get a pretty good plunge of cold air that's going to come straight out of central Canada and really knock our temperatures way down. We might see some overnight lows back in the teens again. And given how the next couple of days we're going to be on a slight warming trend before all that rain arrives to this part of the Corn Belt, that cold air is really going to be a shock to the system. So remember, February, regardless of what the groundhog says, is a very kind of tumultuous month in terms of weather systems. But again, on the whole, we could probably expect to have a slight warm bias to the entire month. And again, that doesn't mean every day is going to be warm, but over the next 20 days or so, it looks like that could be the pattern. And as we've been talking about on your show, I'm thinking that March, April, and May could also carry that slight warm bias, giving us a pretty decent start to the growing season in this part of the Corn Belt.
Always good to talk with you, Eric. Eric Snodgrass, of course, is with Agrible, joins us here on the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Medium. Look us up online at WILLAG.org. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.